ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. Today on The Law Report, a manslaughter investigation into the tragic events at an ice hockey game in the UK.
As the player is falling, his leg's gone up into the air and has connected with the neck of another player. And this has unfortunately led to his death.
A crime or an accident? That's coming up. But first, about a year ago, Australia became all too aware of the serious consequences of juror misconduct when the high-profile trial of Bruce Luhrmann for the alleged rape of his colleague Brittany Higgins in Parliament House was aborted. So, if a juror does their own research in a trial, does that automatically mean that any guilty verdict reached by that jury is dangerous and should be quashed? Well, the High Court has just upheld a conviction despite juror misbehaviour. I'm joined by University of Melbourne criminal law expert Professor Jeremy Gans. Jeremy Gans, so what did the juror do during the trial of the accused HCF?
HCF was facing charges of historical child sexual abuse in Queensland. So he had a trial during the pandemic and it went for a week. There were 2 days of evidence and then the jury sat to deliberate on either side of a weekend. And they were clearly struggling with their deliberations. They almost immediately asked what happens if there's a hung jury. And they kept asking about that. And in the end, they gave down a split verdict. They convicted him on some of the charges, but acquitted him on most. And then the next day, one of the jurors sent the judge a note saying there was a problem in the jury room. There was one juror who said from the outset he wasn't going to convict at all because he'd had his own experience in some way with an allegation of child sexual abuse. And then over the weekend, he came back and said, I've checked and I'm okay convicting on some of these charges because the sentences aren't that high. And the other jurors were talked to him about it. And in the end, he brought down and agreed to some of those verdicts. So the juror sent that judge a note saying, take it or throw it out, but here, I just want you to know about this. And a decade ago, the High Court had said that when a juror sends a note like that, is about something that could affect the verdict, that creates a shadow of injustice and the court needs to investigate. So the court did an investigation. Basically, they emailed all the jurors asking whether anything had happened in the jury room that the court should know about. And 5 of the 12 jurors responded. And a couple of those jurors, including the one who wrote the note, confirmed the story they'd given.
So HCF said, look, my convictions are unsafe. I've been the victim of a miscarriage of justice because of this tainted jury. What did the majority of the High Court of Australia find?
They actually announced a new test to deal with this kind of case. Previously, the courts had peered through the report that the sheriff had created where they'd gone through what all the jurors said and tried to work out if the verdict had been affected. And in Queensland, in the Court of Appeal, they'd said, it looks like the verdict wasn't affected because this one juror, he was actually biased in favour of the defence. So the defence has nothing to complain about. The majority of the High Court said that's not the way to do things. If the issue of the juror misconduct comes out during the trial, the judge can talk to the jurors and try and work out whether he can still get to a verdict that is untainted, maybe give them a direction. Or if you can't, you just have another trial. And everyone agreed there probably would have been another trial if this had come out before the verdict. After the verdict, though, you can't fix things. And so the issue, the court said, is just whether a person who's aware of what's happened or what has likely happened in the jury room would apprehend that this was a bad jury, a jury who just doesn't obey the rules, or one juror who doesn't follow the evidence. If that apprehension was there, you have to have a new trial.
And was that test satisfied here?
They said in this particular case, it was okay. And the reason for that is because the jury had been given the usual direction, don't research anything, don't look up anything, don't look up people, don't look up the law. And they said, that's pretty clear. But they said there's a possibility, or actually an equal chance, that this jury thought that they were actually doing the right thing. They might have thought we're allowed to look up things like just general facts, like how are people sentenced generally, as long as we keep away from this particular case. They weren't sure, said the court. They said it's about a 50-50 chance. Maybe the jury was just a dud jury. But because each of those things were possible, there was every reason, said the court, just to assume that the jury had followed their oath correctly.
So Jeremy Gans, with respect to this jury, had what it done meant that the trial was unsafe, meant that the accused didn't receive a fair trial?
Well, the court said if the jury knew they were doing the wrong thing, then this would have to have been an unfair trial. But the court also said it's equally possible that this jury thought they were doing the right thing in telling this guy, you should keep that out of your mind. You shouldn't have looked that up, but just keep it out of your mind. And maybe this was a good jury doing their best, even though they actually should have told the judge what was going on.
And here the juror wasn't Googling the accused. He was simply Googling what the sentences are likely to be for one kind of child sexual offence as opposed to another kind of child sexual offence.
That's right. And it actually just started a discussion in the jury room. I wonder how these things are sentenced. And in fact, the rest of the juries were sceptical of his research. They weren't even sure he'd done the research. And they argued with him that maybe he even misunderstood what he said he was saying.
Okay. And also because, as you point out, the juror seemed to be quite receptive to the situation of the accused that suggested that he wasn't biased against him and therefore he'd received kind of an unfair trial. How significant is this ruling, Jeremy Gans?
Well, I think the really significant part is that the court actually announced this much tougher test. Although they were lenient in this particular case with this particular sort of research, they've now really announced a much harder line if jurors do anything that they clearly weren't meant to do. Previously, the courts would peer at the verdict and peer at the sheriff report and say, look, maybe the jury did the wrong thing, but it looks like the verdict would have been the same regardless. Under the High Court's new test, that's not a possibility. If the court decides the jury knowingly did the wrong thing, there has to be a new trial, and that's a big deal. In fact, I think the other consequence of this decision is judges are going to give much more extensive directions on what juries aren't allowed to do, a big long list of things they can't do, to make it crystal clear that if the jury does something, they knew they were doing the wrong thing. Of course, it's good for the jury to get clear directions, but I do worry that jurors are only human. They're trying to do the right thing in these trials. They don't want to find out after their verdict that they'd misunderstood something, got it wrong. If they checked on Google, they would have understood it better. Their temptation will still be to check. And although they're not meant to do that, it's kind of understandable they do. And under the High Court's new rule, there's going to be more new trials in that circumstance.
We're speculating, but cycling back 12 months, what do you think, if this test had been on the books then, would the trial of Bruce Lerman have been aborted?
Well, that was discovered during the trial. And so there's a different test at that point. You have to look ahead and say, can we save the verdict? Rather than look backwards and say, was this a good or a bad jury? It's not entirely clear what the High Court would say now about a jury who did that kind of research and it was discovered after the fact. I argued at the time that I felt some sympathy for the jury and wasn't sure that what that juror did was something they realised was something that was forbidden to them. Again, that juror didn't research Brittany Higgins or Bruce Lerman. That juror just researched some general academic research about how rape allegations happen.
Okay, so there were two very significant High Court decisions looking at criminal trials. The other one was involving when evidence should be put to a jury, and it involved two notorious New South Wales crime figures, Roger Rogerson and Glenn McNamara. They're two former corrupt police officers. They were co-defendants in a murder trial of a bloke called Jamie Gow. Tell me about that, and how did this matter reach the High Court?
So Jamie Gow is a drug trafficker. The police's theory is that Rogerson and McNamara shot him for his drugs. But the problem the police had was that McNamara and Rogerson each blamed the other. They said they were just along as bystanders. McNamara was writing a novel about drug runners. And they each said that the other one was the one who shot, to their surprise. The issue that went to the High Court is just one aspect of the mystery of how do you try a case like that where there are two defendants and the prosecution says both of them did it. One way you could do it is to try them separately, where the jury just hears one person's side and doesn't hear the other person's side. But the usual approach in Australia is to put them all in the same room and the jury gets to hear both of their sides and decides both of their cases at the same time.
And McNamara said, "I didn't do it." He points the finger at Roger Rogerson and says, "He told me that he has killed people before and he's going to kill me unless I help him dispose of the body, the man he's just shot." He wants to tell the jury this. He's not allowed to do that, though.
Yeah, this is Glenn McNamara just testifying his own defence, telling what happened and mentioning something that was really relevant, that when Rogerson threatened him, Rogerson mentioned a past crime he'd done. And the judge stopped him and said, "That is relevant, but it's not relevant enough, and it's going to really turn the jury in a bad way, an unfair way, against Roger Rogerson. So we're going to stop you saying what you want to say in your own defence, because we want to make sure the prosecution can fairly try Roger Rogerson at the same time."
So there's this idea that, okay, it might be probative evidence, but it's outweighed by the prejudice that it causes.
Substantially outweighed.
The accused. So McNamara goes all the way to the High Court and says, "But this is unfair. I'm not able to put, you know, really important evidence to the jury." What does the High Court say in this case?
The High Court said that the way most evidence law is designed in Australia, that is how it works. McNamara said, "I want this to be treated as if I'm the only one on trial, and there just happens to be another trial happening in the same room. And I should be able to run it exactly how I would if Rogerson wasn't there." The High Court said, "No, that's not how it works. You're all there, and the judge needs to make that call sometimes about whether something you want to put in your defence is worth the cost of justice." So they upheld his conviction, even though he didn't get to put his whole defence, on the basis that it was fairer to Roger Rogerson to do that.
It's such an interesting case, and I think it captures the imagination because of the sort of the high-profile characters involved. You make the point that both these cases, these decisions of the High Court, could prove very important in a current case before the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal, which is brought by Kathleen Folbig, who is seeking to overturn the four murder convictions for smothering her four children. Now, earlier this year, after spending 20 years in prison, she was released after an independent commission of inquiry found grave doubts about those convictions. These two decisions of the High Court, how do they impact?
I've long worried with Kathleen Folbig's case that it was a very high-profile case, and lots have been published about it. Lots was available on the internet. And there are lots of things a jury who wanted to could find out. And in fact, that's what happened. 16 years ago, it was announced that, in fact, one of the jurors in that case had Googled the case, read websites devoted to it. This isn't just sentencing. This isn't just the law. This is reading about her, and had told the rest of the jury about that. Under the High Court's new approach, I can't see a way that this conviction would have been upheld in those circumstances. And in fact, two of the five judges in the High Court called out the New South Wales decision that upheld Kathleen Folbig's verdict after this jury event had been found out, and said that court clearly applied the wrong test and a test that was too unfair to her. They didn't say that the court got it wrong in the end, but they said that the court reasoned totally wrongly.
Now, from memory, the juror had found out that Kathleen Folbig's father had murdered her mother, and that evidence was deemed to be prejudicial and irrelevant by the trial judge and should not be put to the jury. But the juror had gone off and found this and told the other jurors. So it brings into play both the issues in these latest High Court cases around jury misbehaviour and also prejudicial evidence coming before a jury. So the Court of Criminal Appeal, in deciding whether or not to quash the convictions, will they be looking at these new cases and deciding according to the new law decided?
No one's talked about the fairness of the trial in 16 years. The issue instead has been new evidence suggesting that Kathleen Folbig might have been innocent after all. That's the focus of the court's case, but there's nothing to stop them also looking at the fairness of the trial and revisiting that in light of the High Court's latest judgment.
It'll be very interesting to see. Professor Jeremy Gans, expert in criminal law based at the University of Melbourne Law School, thanks for speaking to the Law Report.
Good to speak to you.
You're listening to the Law Report. Do follow us on the ABC Listen app. British police have arrested a man on suspicion of manslaughter following the death of an ice hockey player who was injured during a game. 29-year-old Adam Johnson died after his neck was cut by the skate of a player from the opposing team. Associate Professor Catherine Ordway is an expert in sports law. She's based at the University of Canberra. Catherine Ordway, what do we know about this game on the 28th of October? It was between the Nottingham Panthers and the Sheffield Steelers.
At the moment, we've only got the media reports that have come in of what appears to be a very tragic accident.
Apparently, the video of the incident shows that Johnson, the deceased, was skating with the puck towards the net, the Steelers' net, and the other player involved in the incident skates towards him, the deceased, collides with another Panthers player, and then that player's left skate kicks up, and as he begins to fall, the blade hits Johnson in the neck. That's what we understand happened from media reports.
Yes, exactly. So it sounds as though there's been a collision, and this is a collision sport in ice hockey where it's very common for players to knock against each other and to fall. And this sounds like as the player is falling, his leg's gone up into the air and has connected with the neck of another player. And the neck is probably one of the very few places on the body of an ice hockey player that isn't protected already with heavy protective gear. And this has unfortunately led to his death.
I know nothing about ice hockey, but it appears to me as a notoriously physical game. And I think you just described it not as a contact sport, but as a collision sport. There's a lot of contact here.
Yes, absolutely. As part of the game, there's a lot of push and shove and contact. And of course, you're on a slippery surface. You're on ice. And these are very proficient ice skaters playing at these professional levels. But you would expect that there will be contact with the sides of the field as well as with each other. And it's also had a culture in past decades. I think it's probably changing, but in past decades, if you didn't have a decent punch-up or a biffo, then people weren't satisfied that this was a fun game. I think that this is changing in a lot of different codes, including ice hockey, but it's still been seen as a very masculine, very violent and toxic kind of a game. I don't think from any of the media reports that this is what's been suggested here, unlike some of the other cases we've seen in the past in ice hockey where there's been a deliberate attempt to attack another player in anger. This is not the way it's being described in this case, and yet we're still dealing with a potential police matter.
So what do we know about other prosecutions, criminal prosecutions on or during ice hockey games? There have been a number of them, haven't there?
Yes, there's been a few that have been in different jurisdictions, not in Australia and as far as I can tell, not in the UK. I mean, neither of those jurisdictions are particularly known for their ice hockey. But in countries like Canada, which are very strong for ice hockey and it's almost their national sport, arguably, then there have been a couple of cases where there have been really violent attacks from between players where the police have been involved. And I think that that might be the kind of case that that's appropriate, where if there's a punch behind the play or the use of the stick as a weapon, because ice hockey, of course, has a hockey stick, and if they're using that as a weapon to hit somebody else deliberately, then maybe that's the kind of case where the police should intervene. But it's a really interesting ethical question, isn't it, about whether or not what happens on the field of play should stay on the field of play, or whether or not we should have the police intervene in cases where we say this is well beyond the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, some of those cases are very interesting, and some of them are a long time ago now. There was one involving Jim Bonney, an Italian-Canadian player who was charged in Italy with culpable homicide after he slashed another player in the chest during a game. And that other player, Miron Schrott, died as a result of a cardiac arrest. Bonnie pleaded guilty to manslaughter, and I think maybe it's under a different legal system, but he had to pay restitution to the family. So maybe that was under the Italian legal system.
The Italians do take a different view towards sport than we do in our jurisdiction. In an anti-doping setting, for example, they actually have doping as a crime, and that's caused some issues over the years when we've had, of course, international events there and the Winter Olympics, of course, held in Italy. So their attitude perhaps is one where sport doesn't enjoy the protections that we allow in jurisdictions coming from the British system, where sport was considered a gentleman's game and pastime.
And in Canadian criminal courts, two National Hockey League players have faced prosecutions. In 2000, Marty McSorley was found guilty of assault with a deadly weapon for a two-handed slash to the head with his hockey stick. He was sentenced to 18 months probation. And in 2004, Todd Bertuzzi pleaded guilty to assault for grabbing a player from behind and sucker punching him. He was sentenced to 1 year's probation and 80 hours of community service. So we know in the UK, in relation to Adam Johnson's recent death, an unnamed person has been arrested and was reportedly released on bail the following day, and the police confirmed that there is an ongoing manslaughter investigation. Catherine Ordway, there's also a very interesting case in Uganda. Tell me about that.
In that case, this was from 2020, where apparently there were two players from the same team, and one player was upset that his teammate made a defensive blunder, it's reported, and it meant the other team scored. And apparently the player was so incensed that he went and attacked his fellow teammate on the field, and officials had to pull them apart. And later after the game, that wasn't enough. The attacking player went after his teammate and attacked him so violently in the car park afterwards that the police pronounced him dead a few hours later, and a murder investigation was opened in relation to that matter. So that's a pretty serious response to letting in a goal on behalf of your team.
And the alleged crime started during a game and continued post the game.
Yes.
And we don't know what happened in that case, do we?
No.
The media reports on that death from 2020 in Uganda. What about here in Australia? Have there been criminal charges for on-field conduct here in Australia?
There's been very, very few, actually, surprisingly, given the number of different cases that we've seen of on-field punches behind the play, the famous Barry Hall kind of cases and the Hopewate kind of finger poke cases, the number of different eye gouging cases. But none of those have been referred to the police, which is interesting, and we should wonder whether that's appropriate or not. But the ones that have been referred, then we should ask ourselves perhaps why they have. There was a famous one from 1985 where Hawthorne's Lee Matthews was charged following a behind play hit where the players moved down the field and his king hits another player. In that case, that was Geelong's Neville Bruns. And that was referred for criminal charges.
What happened in that case? There was a conviction?
There was a conviction in that case, yeah. But that case of Lee Matthews really struck home because it meant that the message was sent out not just to the Code of Aussie Rules but more broadly that the police can and will get involved, and so you really need to get your house in order, otherwise this is going to be more common.
In 2017, we saw criminal charges laid against Ali Fahour in Melbourne for a kind of essentially a suburban game. Tell me what happened in that case.
Well, what we know about that case is that the two things that were interesting about that is that one is that Mr. Fahour actually worked for the AFL as a diversity manager. And he was charged with assault for a punch to another player. And during, as you say, it was wasn't an AFL level game, but it was a Northern Football League game, so much lower level down the food chain. And what's interesting is that this wasn't a kind of a skirmish in the game, but actually something had happened on the field, and Mr. Fahour ran down the field and launched at another player, Saddington, and King hit him from running down the other end of the field. So that caused such a big shock that people thought that was so outlandish that it was referred to the police. And I think the fact that he worked for the AFL would have also been part of the decision-making process for the AFL to press charges and to make sure that action was taken by the police in that case.
And he later pleaded guilty to recklessly causing injury and I think received a two-year community corrections order and was ordered to pay $5,000 to Disability Sports Australia. But he avoided a criminal conviction.
And more importantly, perhaps for him, it meant that he had to resign from probably what was his dream job, working with the AFL. Which was an enormous sanction in the end.
Mm, and you think there that the big, what separated it out from other kind of violent incidents which take place on the field is that it wasn't in the course of play. It wasn't in the heat of the moment around the ball. Fahour actually ran to the other end of the oval and away from play to hit this guy.
Yes, and so it made it really obvious for the umpires to pick up, because of course action that happens behind the play is quite often missed by umpires because they're watching the ball and the people around the ball. So if there's something that happens, you know, 10 metres behind them, it's quite often outside of their field of vision and they miss it. But this one was unmissable.
Now, Catherine Ordway, coming back to the recent dreadful events at the ice hockey game in the UK, what do you think police will be looking for when deciding whether or not to press charges and what kinds of charges? We understand it's a manslaughter investigation.
At the moment, they're talking about it being manslaughter, which suggests that there's some kind of recklessness here, is that it was in some way preventable. And it's very difficult, given the fact scenario that we've been provided at the moment, to imagine that it was preventable or that the player falling had any way of preventing it. Perhaps he shouldn't have kicked his leg up in the air and he should have realised that that would have been dangerous, to allow your leg to fly up in the air when you've got a sharp steel blade on the end of it. Perhaps that's the argument.
Given what little we know about the incident, there might be other kind of issues or other information which might come to light, which might make for a kind of a more clear-cut case. But at this stage, it's pretty mysterious.
It's very mysterious. We just don't have enough information to know at the moment why the police would consider that they have sufficient evidence to bring a prosecution at this time.
Associate Professor Catherine Ordway, sports law expert at the University of Canberra, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
You're very welcome.
And that's all we have time for on this episode of The Law Report. Big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to technical producer Tim Simons. Now, a correction. On our last program, we discussed proceedings before the Victorian Supreme Court involving convicted terrorist Abdul Nasser Ben Bricker. In these proceedings, the federal government is seeking an extended supervision order, not an extension of a continuing detention order, which is what I wrongly suggested in last week's program. So important to clarify. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.